Good afternoon, everyone. Hola a todos. Buenas tardes. We will start on time because we want to have a lot of time for questions and answers. We have simultaneous translation, English, Spanish, and we have a presenter who will speak in French, but his slides are in English, and we will help him by translating any questions he may get and his answers also. Hay traducción simultánea para quienes lo necesiten. Espero que tengan los audífonos. I want to welcome you all to this symposium on scaling up HIV testing and counseling. I'm Anna Langer, President of Engender Health, and before taking this position in New York, I lived for many years here in Mexico, where I led health research and policy development in this country and the region. I'm very glad to be moderating this session in particular today, because it is a subject that I think about often, and that is because in many ways it is a new manifestation of a recurrent question in health policy. How do we strike a balance between the good intentions of the public health community with the need to respect and protect individual rights and ensure informed consent? As you know, there are two main approaches to HIV testing right now, and they share a common assumption that knowing one's status means an individual will access additional counseling and services that can change behavior and or jumpstart a regimen of life-preserving medication. One approach, which in recent years has garnered increased attention, follows the WHO recommendation that HIV counseling and testing be administered to everyone with the possibility of opting out. This is a classic public health approach based on the assumption that if those in need of treatment can be identified, they will receive services, disease incidence will drop, and lives will be extended through proper care. Surrounding this approach are legitimate concerns about whether real informed consent to opt out of testing is possible in light of the power imbalances between service providers and clients. The other approach is to rely on voluntary counseling and testing and starts with the assumption that if testing services are known to be available in a community, individuals may decide for themselves whether to be tested. It is not a default component of healthcare as in the first scenario. Further, the notion is that when people are self-motivated to know their status, they will be that much more inclined to do something about it, whether positive or negative. So what we have here is the crux of so many public health debates through time, a sweeping effort that includes everyone, or a voluntary approach emphasizing individual choice and rights. A classic example of this debate is mandatory mass vaccination programs, which have contributed to some of the greatest success stories of public health in the last 100 years. But a critical difference between the decision to commit to mass vaccine programs and the current question of which model of HIV counseling and testing should prevail is that the former was based on very clear evidence that it was a method that worked, and the latter is not, at least so far. I serve on the World Health Organization Advisory Committee on Health Research and believe so strongly that policy must be informed by evidence. And right now, we need to know more about which approach to HIV counseling and testing actually leads to more individuals accessing prevention, care, and treatment services, adhering to a regimen of prevention or care, and reducing stigma and discrimination. And so we are here today to examine more closely each strategy, the ethical implications of each, and most importantly, the evidence that the desired outcome, life-preserving behavior change, is achievable. Judging by how many of you are here, I know this is an issue that weighs heavily on many hearts and minds. To further frame our thinking today, we have four speakers and a discussant. Dr. Ralph Jurgens of the UNAIDS Reference Group on HIV and Human Rights, who will talk about the recommendations of the UNAIDS Reference Group to address these questions. Then Aliu Sila will take us to Mali to see how provider-initiated testing and counseling can be done and scaled up while ensuring human rights, informed consent, and confidentiality. Next, Amara Quesada will explain mandatory HIV testing programs that are in place for migrant workers in Asia and the impact it has on migrants themselves and on their families. Dr. Nduku Kilonzo will report on her program in Kenya that reaches roughly 250,000 individuals a year with various approaches for voluntary counseling and testing, and will examine the gender implications of different approaches. And then, Gracia Violeta Ros Quiroga of Bolivia will start our discussion of what these programs, their approaches, and the evidence supporting them, or lack thereof, means as we look ahead. I will now introduce our first speaker, Dr. Ralph Jurgens, and we'll introduce each of them before their turn. Just a quick announcement. You may have found evaluation forms on your seats, so please fill them out and give them to a volunteer. So let me say a few words about Ralph. Ralph is the co-founder of the Canadian HIV and AIDS Legal Network and served as its executive director from 1998 to November 2004. Since December 2004, he has worked as a consultant on HIV and AIDS, health, policy, and human rights in Eastern Europe, Central Asia, Africa, and Canada. He's a member of the UN Global Reference Group on HIV and AIDS and Human Rights, and in 2006, co-chaired the policy track at the 16th International AIDS Conference in Toronto. A prolific writer on the subjects of legal, ethical, and human rights issues related to HIV, he also taught the first course ever on AIDS and the law in a Canadian university. Ralph, it's a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you very much, Anna, and thank you very much to the organizers of the conference for inviting me to address you today. And thanks to all of you for turning out in such great numbers to the session on HIV testing. In my presentation, first of all, I would like to acknowledge the Open Society Institute Public Health Program and some of the people who have worked with me on HIV testing and counseling issues, as well as the members of the UNAIDS Reference Group on HIV and Human Rights, who have helped me organize my thoughts around this issue. As you know, in recent years, there has been a call to not only expand and ensure quality in voluntary counseling and testing services, but also to explore other models of testing, including provider-initiated testing and counseling, which I will now call PITC. As you know, in May 2007, WHO and UNAIDS released guidance on PITC in health facilities. More recently, separate testing policy statements have been developed for some of the most vulnerable populations, such as prisoners and people who use drugs. One of these UNAIDS, UNODC, and WHO statements is about to be released and is summarized in a poster that is being presented at the conference today. And you see the poster number on this slide. It is the new policy statement on HIV testing and counseling for prisoners. Now, the World Health Organization and UNAIDS testing guidance, as you know, strongly supports efforts to scale up testing and counseling services through diverse methods, including client-initiated and provider-initiated testing and counseling. Under certain circumstances, as Anna said, the guidance recommends that people in healthcare settings be tested after receiving information about the HIV test, unless they specifically decline the HIV test. While the May 2007 guidance has generally been well received, concerns have been raised about several aspects of the guidance. In particular, some have raised the question whether it is possible to increase access to HIV testing and counseling and implement the guidance while respecting human rights. It is important to recognize first that the efforts to increase access to HIV testing and counseling are not occurring in a vacuum. Rather, they take place in an environment in which evidence-informed and human rights-based policies and responses to HIV are being widely undermined. Rather than providing opiate substitution treatment, for example, ineffective drug treatment remains the norm for many people who are dependent on drugs in many countries in the world. Abstinence-based education continues receiving a lot of support despite its limitations. In contrast, laws criminalizing exposure to HIV or transmission of HIV are being passed in a large number of countries despite a lack of evidence that these laws may have any preventative effect, and at the same time laws protecting women and providing them with equal opportunities and chances linger on legislative agendas in many countries. Furthermore, even as vastly increased funding for HIV has become available, those who are most vulnerable to HIV continue to receive the least access to HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. In addition, studies have provided evidence that even before new forms of HIV testing were introduced, abuses around the manner in which HIV testing and counseling have been conducted are commonplace. My presentation is based on work I did for the Open Society Institute Public Health Program and on a statement and recommendations by the UNAIDS Reference Group on HIV and Human Rights, which was issued in response to the WHO and UNAIDS guidance. The UNAIDS Reference Group on Human Rights, for those who don't know this group, is an independent body which advises UNAIDS on matters related to HIV and human rights. The views of the reference group do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of UNAIDS. I am a member of the reference group and drafted the statement with the help of all members of the reference group. I hope that at the end of the session, both the UNAIDS reference group statement and a short summary of my presentation will be available to all of you as you leave the session. As part of the work that I have undertaken, I carried out a comprehensive search of the published scientific literature using electronic databases. I also reviewed conference abstracts and conducted searches on the internet. Particularly, I made attempts to obtain as much information as possible from low- and middle-income countries, including through UN country officers and through key informant interviews. In my presentation, I hope I will be able to show that it is not only possible to scale up access to HIV testing and counseling while respecting human rights, but that it is indeed necessary. Scaling up HIV testing without respect of human rights not only leads to human rights infringements, but also harms public health efforts. Indeed, there is a consensus about key aspects of HIV testing and counseling among public health and human rights experts. Overcoming the remaining differences would greatly benefit the efforts to scale up access to not only HIV testing and counseling, but importantly also to scale up access to HIV prevention and treatment, care, and support. So let me start by pointing out the areas in which there is consensus. Firstly, there is consensus about the need to scale up access to HIV testing and counseling. AIDS and human rights activists, public health officials, and policymakers all agree about the need for vastly scaled up access to affordable and high quality testing. There is also near consensus that introduction of provider initiated testing is necessary. Evidence, in fact, suggests that many opportunities to diagnose and counsel individuals at health facilities are missed when systems rely solely on clients to initiate voluntary counseling and testing. Introducing some form of PITC in healthcare settings, in some countries at least, is important for many reasons and is widely supported. While informed consent, counseling, and confidentiality remain critical, most also agree that it is justified to relax pre-test counseling requirements in some settings. Human rights and public health do not require cumbersome procedures for pre-test counseling, but they do require that, regardless of whether persons initiate HIV testing and counseling themselves, or whether they are offered an HIV test in a healthcare setting, they can seek and receive sufficient information to enable them to give informed and truly voluntary consent to testing. They also require that people receive sufficient post-test counseling and that confidentiality of test results and of the fact of seeking a test are guaranteed. However, there are several concerns about the testing guidance or the way it is being implemented, and I will now turn to these concerns. Firstly, there's concerns about the fact that WHO and UNAIDS recommend an approach to PITC under which people are tested unless they specifically decline the HIV test or opt out of the HIV test. Informed consent is difficult to achieve under any system. It may be even more difficult to achieve when people are tested unless they specifically decline the test. The optimal balance between public health and human rights approaches to HIV testing may lie in routinely offering and recommending HIV testing and counseling, but requiring that clients specifically agree to the test, rather than having to decline it. A provider-initiated opt-in approach may be especially appropriate for highly vulnerable populations, such as sex workers, people who use drugs, and prisoners. Secondly, there's concern that efforts to scale up access to HIV testing and counseling fail to devote greater attention to how client-initiated VCT services can be implemented, can be improved and scaled up. VCT is particularly important because a large number of people do not use formal health services, and these people may need other ways to gain access to HIV testing and counseling. This is especially true for people living in rural areas, poorly served by the health system, mobile populations, and vulnerable communities such as sex workers, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons, and people who use drugs who face stigma and discrimination in health settings. Thirdly, there's concern that efforts to increase access to HIV testing are not always sufficiently linked to larger prevention and treatment care and support goals. Efforts to scale up access to HIV testing and counseling should always be coordinated and integrated with increased efforts to scale up access to ART and to evidence-based prevention. Many countries are currently far from providing much-needed treatment and prevention, and there is concern that the push for increased HIV testing is happening exactly at a time when governments, international agencies, and funders are stepping back from ambitious goals like the 3x5 initiative or universal access by 2010, and are failing to put in place the resources needed to ensure that treatment and prevention are vastly scaled up and become universally available. There's also concern about the fact that increasing testing and counseling rarely goes hand in hand with establishing strong and enforceable legal frameworks for protection against HIV-related discrimination and abuse. In many countries, people who experience breaches of confidentiality, employment discrimination, domestic violence, and other abuses following HIV testing enjoy no legal recourse. This can only serve as a disincentive for others to be tested. There's concern further that many of the discussions and assumptions around HIV testing and counseling have occurred in the absence of empirical data, either from studies or from monitoring of existing programs. Particularly outside the prenatal context, evidence about the impact of PITC remains very limited, and deeper research questions beyond simply the number of people getting tested need to be adequately addressed to ensure that testing and counseling are having their intended effect. Questions such as the following should be addressed. What is the experience of people being tested as a result of approaches in which HIV testing is more routine? Would opt-out approaches to PITC lead to a greater chance of negative consequences, including human rights abuses and particularly against women, than opt-in approaches? Would such forms of HIV testing normalize HIV and reduce HIV stigma to a greater extent than forms of HIV testing under which people are offered the test, but tested only if they explicitly agree to the test? Would such forms of testing result in greater or lesser uptake of ART? To what extent is the ability to scale up treatment currently being restricted by a testing gap rather than by other factors? And many other such research questions remain unanswered. Finally, there is concern that mandatory and compulsory HIV testing continue to occur in many countries and contexts. There is concern that making testing more routine and adopting opt-out approaches may in practice result in even more instances of HIV testing without consent. In conclusion, far from being opposed to efforts to vastly increase access to HIV testing and counseling, human rights advocates have been among the first to argue that greater access to HIV testing is not only a public health imperative, but also a critical aspect of protecting and promoting the right to the highest attainable standard of health. I would therefore like to invite those public health experts who have been critical of human rights-based approaches to HIV to open their minds and understand that human rights activists are their greatest allies in the fight against HIV, and that promotion and protection of human rights is not only required by law and the right thing to do, but also essential to the success of public health efforts. Those who have attacked human rights activists should consider that it was human rights activists who, faced with much resistance, claimed the human right of millions in low-resource countries to HIV treatments, including ARVs. They are also the ones who are at the forefront of battles to increase access to evidence-based prevention measures. Human rights activists will be at the side of public health experts and WHO as they scale up HIV testing and counseling, provided the concerns I briefly discussed above are taken into account and addressed. Where necessary, sufficient measures must be put in place prior to and during implementation of PITC to ensure that the prerequisites for PITC are indeed in place. Access to HIV prevention care and support services, sufficient capacity of healthcare providers to implement PITC under the conditions of informed consent, confidentiality and counseling, and sufficient programmatic attention to protecting people from stigma and discrimination. For additional information, seek out these documents that are available at the websites of UNAIDS and the Soros Foundation. And as I mentioned, I hope that at the end of the session, these documents will also be available to you in hard copy. Many thanks.
Thank you, Ron. We will hear now from Aliou Sylla from Mali. As I said before, he'll speak in French, but his slides are in English, and we will translate for him as needed. Aliou is a physician specialized in community medicine. He established the first center for VCT treatment, care, and support in Mali called CESAC. He was the director of that center for 10 years, and now he's the AIDS director of the Ministry of Health and the president of ARCAD-SIDA, and member and co-founder of the International Plus Coalition Against AIDS. Aliou?
rapport au test et au conseil dans le contexte du respect des droits de l'homme, et surtout le cas du Mali. Et mon plan de présentation est le suivant, c'est rapidement parler de l'introduction, de la situation épidémiologique dans mon pays, du passage à échelle, des résultats, des difficultés rencontrées et une conclusion. Par rapport à l'épidémie du VIH dans les années 70-80, nous savons que c'est une pathologie qui a été perçue avec différentes connotations d'ordre moral, de la honte, de la mort, et c'était une forme de peur dont les agents de santé n'avaient pas la solution. Et ça a contribué à développer le stigma et la discrimination. Et surtout dans nos différents pays maintenant, on a vu qu'il n'y a que dans le monde 10% de personnes qui sont connues séropositives et qui ont pu faire leur dépistage. Donc c'est un vrai problème par rapport à l'insuffisance de se faire dépister. Donc quelle est la situation épidémiologique dans mon pays? Au niveau du Mali, c'est un pays qui est situé au niveau de l'Afrique de l'Ouest, qui est peuplé de 12 millions d'habitants, avec une prévalence de 1,3% selon l'enquête DHH 2006. Mais cette prévalence est très variable. Si nous prenons au niveau des groupes vulnérables, ça varie de 2,2 à 35,3. Donc cela nous amène à considérer que notre épidémie, bien vrai que nous avons une prévalence faible, est considérée de type généralisé. Et vous voyez, ça c'est pour la comparaison des deux enquêtes DHS 2001-2006 au niveau de la population générale, et nous voyons que les femmes sont plus concernées que les hommes. Par rapport aux groupes vulnérables, nous avons mis le point sur le sex worker et qui sont à 35,3% dans une prévalence globale de 1,3 et les routiers qui sont à peu près à 6%. Donc cela veut dire que nous avons vraiment du travail à faire. Maintenant, qu'est-ce que nous avons fait par rapport au passage à échelle? Au niveau du Mali, avant 2001, il n'y avait qu'une seule structure qui s'occupait de faire le test. C'était le CESAC. C'est une structure qui est délocalisée, qui est en dehors de l'hôpital, qui est au niveau ambulatoire. Et en 2001, il y a le Programme national de lutte contre le sida qui a entrepris des voyages d'études au niveau de l'Afrique du Sud pour essayer de s'inspirer par rapport à ce qui se faisait au niveau du dépistage volontaire. Et enfin, nous avons eu à élaborer des documents par rapport à la formation, à la compétence des agents de santé et essayer de valider les tests rapides. L'INRSP, c'est l'Institut national de recherche en santé publique dans notre pays, et les tests rapides retenus au niveau du Mali, c'était Determine, Oraquick et Emastrib, à partir de 700 échantillons sanguins au niveau du CESAC. Et à partir de là, nous avons élaboré le premier algorithme qui était de faire le Determine, s'il est positif, de faire l'Oraquick, s'il y a la discordance, de le confirmer avec l'Emastrib. Et enfin, nous sommes rendus compte qu'on ne peut pas proposer le dépistage, faire sa promotion, s'il n'y a pas de service d'accès aux soins. C'est pourquoi le Mali, en mettant en place son initiative d'accès au traitement, palliait à ce vide-là. Et avec une ONG internationale qui est PSI, le premier centre de dépistage a vu le jour avec son label qui s'appelle le Centre Éveil. Et vers 2002-2004, nous avons commencé à documenter, et là nous avons implémenté les 23 centres de dépistage volontaire avec l'appui d'un partenaire aussi qui est Plan International, et nous avons essayé de développer le dépistage qu'on appelle à stratégie avancée. Et en 2005, vraiment, cette mise en place des centres de dépistage volontaire a continué. Et en 2006, nous avons essayé de sortir un document pour sortir les normes et procédures par rapport au dépistage et essayer de voir comment nous pouvons intégrer les services de dépistage dans les centres de santé communautaires, c'est les centres de santé de proximité dans nos pays. Et en 2007, nous avons sorti un guide par rapport au dépistage vraiment mobile. En 2008, nous sommes en train de mettre en place les services de dépistage au niveau des centres de santé communautaires. Donc nous sommes actuellement à l'intégration des services. Quelques résultats. Vous voyez, c'est de 2001 à 2007, c'était un seul centre. Et la progression, en 2007, nous sommes arrivés à 80 centres de dépistage et de conseil volontaire. Et par rapport à ceci, pendant 3 ans de recul, en termes de testing, de counseling, à peu près 200 000 personnes ont été testées pour à peu près 15 000 personnes positives. Mais quels ont été les problèmes? C'est une réalité. Tout de suite, je vous disais qu'il y a eu 15 000 personnes positives. Cela ne veut pas dire qu'au Mali, on n'a pas beaucoup de personnes qui doivent aujourd'hui connaître leur sérologie et que leur prise en charge soit facilitée. On a été confronté à un problème d'insuffisance de ressources humaines qualifiées. Le conseil de dépistage, ce n'est pas le fort des médecins. Et que les procédures pour faire le dépistage, les différentes étapes du pré-test, de l'évaluation des risques, des plans de réduction des risques, de l'information aux clients, de l'annonce de la séropositivité, de l'acceptation, constituent un lourd fardeau pour beaucoup de médecins qui n'ont pas eu la formation qualifiée à ce niveau. Nous avons aussi le problème de disponibilité des médecins qui, aujourd'hui, par rapport au test, le test prend du temps. Et surtout par rapport à la forme classique que nous sommes en train de faire par rapport au pré-test et au post-test. Nous avons l'insuffisance de l'intégration du VCT au niveau des services de santé. Et l'un des problèmes aussi auxquels nous sommes confrontés, c'est le problème de financement des centres de dépistage volontaires. Beaucoup de nos centres ont souffert par rapport au manque de financement pour qu'ils puissent continuer leur programme. Ensuite, la vraie question, c'est la question des droits humains. En mettant l'accent sur le fait que le dépistage doit être conditionné au consentement éclairé du patient, comment arriver à promouvoir le dépistage pour qu'on puisse mettre les patients sous traitement en respectant les droits humains? C'est une vraie question aujourd'hui pour nous dans la réflexion, les droits humains individuels versus les droits humains collectifs. Car pour nous, le VCT doit servir à être un outil de prévention. Les personnes qui sont séronégatives doivent rester séronégatives. On ne peut pas, dans le contexte de gratuité, dans le contexte de l'accès au traitement, maintenir cette stratégie de pré-test tout en procédure. La réflexion aujourd'hui, devons-nous pas voir comment faciliter, former, outiller les agents de santé, tous les autres conseillers, pour proposer un dépistage simplifié. Ensuite, qu'est-ce qui nous a posé comme problème aussi? C'est par rapport à la conservation des tests rapides. C'est un vrai problème dans nos pays africains. Les tests qui nous sont destinés, nous prenons le cas de l'Hemastrip, la durée de vie est de 9 mois. Et quand on nous demande de conserver les tests à des températures entre plus 2 degrés et plus 30 degrés, ce n'est pas facile. Souvent, ça peut aller dans nos différents pays jusqu'à 40 degrés. Donc, en ce moment, quel type de test l'industrie pharmaceutique peut promouvoir pour nous faciliter quand même cette bonne conservation afin que les résultats soient considérés comme des résultats fiables? Ça aussi, ça a été les difficultés auxquelles nous avons été confrontés. L'autre difficulté réelle, c'est l'annonce. L'annonce de la séropositivité. Annoncer veut dire annoncer la mort. Donc, une difficulté réelle qui est là, où au niveau des structures de santé, des hôpitaux, les agents de santé, se disant n'étant pas formés à cela, préfèrent faire le test à l'insu. Mais aujourd'hui, dans notre contexte où on parle d'accès universel, est-ce que nous tous, nous ne devons pas revoir notre propre vision? Parce qu'actuellement, nous devons dépasser nous-mêmes notre propre peur, notre propre angoisse par rapport aux tests et aux conseils. Nous nous cachons derrière des alibis. Comment nous pouvons, 25 ans après, nous ne parvenons pas à freiner les nouvelles infections? 25 ans après, le nombre de personnes dans le monde qui connaissent son statut est très faible. Donc c'est vraiment une réflexion et c'est un handicap au passage à échelle. Et en conclusion, aujourd'hui, pour nous, nous devons connaître notre statut sérologique pour bénéficier de façon précoce les traitements appropriés, les soins adaptés. Nous devons promouvoir et encourager fortement vraiment le opt-out et que nous trouvons des agents, des experts aujourd'hui. Nous avons des patients experts, nous avons des conseillers qui puissent assurer le conseil continu pour que le travail du médecin soit plus facilité. Et nous devons tout faire que notre stratégie de dépistage nous permette de réduire le nombre de nouvelles infections et d'encourager l'implémentation des centres de dépistage volontaire ou des services de dépistage volontaire au niveau des groupes vulnérables, tels que les hommes qui ont des rapports sexuels avec les hommes, tels que les sex workers, tels que les handicapés, tels que les jeunes filles. Il faudrait qu'on puisse vraiment avoir le courage, qu'il soit politique, qu'il soit technique et qu'il soit financier, pour promouvoir l'utilisation des services de dépistage volontaire avec des tests simples, rapides, maniables et efficaces, et enfin de réduire le stigma et la discrimination par des approches communicationnelles. Qu'on puisse nous tous penser aujourd'hui. Certes, il n'y a pas de vaccin que nous sommes en train de chercher par rapport au sida. Mais la trithérapie, au moins, est le vaccin que nous connaissons. Donc, cette trithérapie, communiquons autour pour lutter, diminuer le stigma et la discrimination. Et les personnes vivant avec le VIH, les personnes les plus concernées, doivent être vraiment à l'avant-garde. Notre militantisme aujourd'hui doit être là pour protéger ceux qui sont séronégatifs. Donc pour nous, c'est aujourd'hui un véritable impératif de santé publique. Et au Mali aujourd'hui, voilà la répartition des 80 VCTI à travers le pays. Je vous remercie.
Merci Aliou. We will now hear from Amara Quesada. She's a program officer for Action and Health Initiatives, ACHIEVE, in the Philippines, a position she has held for more than 7 years, conducting research examining the HIV vulnerabilities of migrant workers and the impact of HIV on these workers and their families. Through the coordination of Action Research on AIDS and Mobility in Asia, CARAM Asia, she has helped set a regional agenda for action research on mandatory HIV testing, looking specifically at migrant workers' access to health information and services. As a trainer, Amara has worked with governments, provincial and district hospitals, and private medical clinics to improve their HIV services for migrant workers. Amara?
Thank you, Anna. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this session. My presentation this afternoon is based largely on the work that we do in Action for Health Initiatives in the Philippines, as well as our network, the Coordination of Action Research and on AIDS and Mobility in Asia. Although I will be mentioning migrants in general, this presentation focuses on the experiences of migrant workers from Asia. To start off, here is a quote from a Singaporean doctor. Most HIV positives in our country are migrant workers. You are the ones bringing the virus to our country, so the best thing you could do is to get out of Singapore to avoid transmitting the virus. I would like to apologize if there are Singaporeans in the audience. I'm sure this is not a reflection of every Singaporean's attitude towards migrants living with HIV. But this is a situation that was faced by a migrant domestic worker. He said this to a migrant domestic worker after telling her that she tested positive for HIV. The government of Singapore imposes mandatory HIV testing for migrants who want to work or reside there. Spot checks that include HIV tests are also conducted among seafarers whose vessels dock in the country. To date, there are still 67 countries that require HIV testing as a precondition for granting entry, stay, residence, or work to foreigners. Many of these countries receive large numbers of migrant workers from Asian countries. Countries in the Middle East, for instance, host majority of labor migrants coming from South and Southeast Asia. Let me take a step back and look at the policies in the origin countries, the countries where most migrant workers come from, regarding HIV testing. In a study done by Karam Asia in 2007 on the state of health of migrants, focusing on mandatory health testing, it showed that national AIDS policies in labor-sending countries prohibit mandatory or compulsory testing. This is true for the Philippines, Cambodia, Nepal, Indonesia, and Thailand, to mention a few. These national policies also include provisions to ensure that voluntary HIV tests are conducted with consent, pre-test and post-test counseling, and protects confidentiality. HIV-related services, particularly treatment and care, are available and accessible in these countries in varying degrees. This prohibition on mandatory testing also extends to foreigners in most of these countries. Unfortunately, there are some labor-sending countries like Bangladesh where deportation might be an option by the government if a foreigner's HIV-positive status becomes known. However, policies that look very good on paper do not necessarily look well in implementation. People who want to migrate for work abroad have to undergo HIV testing, along with a host of other medical tests. Oftentimes, these tests are done without knowledge or consent of the pre-departing migrant. When asked, many of the migrants who participated in the study that I just mentioned would just say that they get tested for everything but do not really know what specific tests are being done. When you ask them if they know they got tested for HIV, those who say yes know only because their blood was drawn from them, but there is no information regarding how or whether they are tested for HIV. In our experience, migrant workers who test positive for HIV only realize that they are tested after they get the devastating result. Because these tests are treated as a requirement, there really is no true consent. If you don't want to be tested, you cannot work abroad. Furthermore, the HIV tests that are conducted in these contexts are done generally without pre-test or post-test counseling. In Cambodia and in the Philippines, there is post-test counseling, but only for those who tested positive for HIV. This is conducted not by the medical clinics who conducted the tests, but the government hospitals where the results are confirmed. Also, results of these tests, including HIV, are disclosed to recruitment agents. There are isolated cases where HIV-positive test results are disclosed exclusively to the patient, but these are rare and does not represent the general practice. There are countries with national AIDS policies that have referral mechanisms for persons who test positive for HIV, but there are still countries where this system is not in place, so migrants who have tested positive for HIV are simply sent home to their villages and communities with no knowledge as to how or where to access services when they need them. However, the bottom line is that when a prospective migrant has a positive HIV test result, the migrant can no longer migrate for work or residence in the countries that require mandatory HIV testing. Despite having national policies that prohibit mandatory HIV testing, migrants still go through it because it is a requirement of the destination countries. Because most destination countries demand for the fittest migrant workers, and HIV test is one of the criteria to determine fitness to work. Mandatory HIV tests for migrants who apply for work, residence, or student visas are done again upon arrival in the destination countries, particularly in the Middle East and some destination countries in Southeast and East Asia. These mandatory tests are repeated at regular intervals, like when a migrant renews her or his contract or decides to change employers. Just like the actual conduct of HIV tests in origin countries, HIV tests in the destination countries are done in violation of internationally accepted guidelines on HIV testing. There is no information, no consent, no counseling, and the result is also disclosed to the authorities even before migrants are informed of it. And because having an HIV positive result leads to deportation, migrant workers are not referred to services, and there have been stories of migrants who were simply picked up by the police and brought to detention centers without any explanation, like the case of Jerry. He underwent HIV testing in Dubai as part of his application for work visa. When he tested positive for HIV, he was detained for more than a month in a hospital ward that was guarded by the police. Nobody told him why he was there. It was only when he was about to be deported that his prospective employer told him why he is being sent back to his country. And when it came time for Jerry to be sent home, he was handcuffed and escorted by the police to the airport like a common criminal. It should be noted that the nationals of these countries which impose mandatory testing on migrants are not treated this way. As reflected in the attitude of the Singaporean doctor that was in the quote earlier, the blame is put on migrants as carriers of disease and should therefore be expelled from their lands. There are two reasons why these countries continue to impose mandatory HIV testing. According to them, they are simply safeguarding their public's health and preventing the spread of HIV among the local population. They also refuse to allocate resources for the health of migrants. This stark manifestation of discrimination not only traumatizes the migrants who are affected, but also creates a false sense of security on the part of the nationals of those countries, believing that as long as they get rid of the migrants who bring in HIV, it will not spread among the local population. There is simply a great denial of the fact that HIV is already in these countries. And deporting migrants who are HIV positive will in no way lessen the spread of HIV. In fact, these punitive and discriminatory measures only serve to force migrants who may suspect their HIV status to become undocumented, to hide their condition in order to keep working and earning for their families back home. Going underground leaves them unable to access information and services that may lead to higher chances of unknowingly infecting others. Which then brings us to a concern when we look at the framework of scaling up HIV testing and counseling. Of course, there is a need to scale up and to make testing and counseling widely available as long as it protects the rights of people, is utilized as a gateway for prevention through proper counseling, and leads to treatment and services. What worries us is that public health as an imperative that fuels scaling up testing and counseling is also the rationale presented by countries that impose mandatory HIV testing. In the context of mandatory testing as conducted among migrants, the problem is not that there are no available testing services. In fact, testing is made available and migrants have no real choice but to utilize them. The problem in this context is that there is no respect, no promotion, and no protection of migrants' human rights every time they undergo mandatory HIV testing. Especially problematic is the fact that deportation practices go hand in hand with mandatory HIV testing policies in many countries. There is no room for counseling, no interest to provide it in the first place, and definitely no chance to access services. Destination countries that deport migrants based on HIV status also do not do referral to service providers in origin countries. The impact is a complex psychological, emotional, and physical trauma brought on by an abrupt loss of opportunity to work, aggravated by the experience of detention, deportation, and discrimination. What we all want is a human rights-based HIV counseling and testing that is a true gateway for prevention and leads to services. We in CARAM therefore propose the following, that along with the campaign to scale up human rights-based HIV testing and counseling, there is an urgent need to call for removal of all mandatory testing policies and practices for migrants. detention and deportation, and other punitive practices in relation to HIV status should be eliminated. Instead, there is a need to scale up HIV preventive education, and CARAM calls for the institutionalization of migrant-friendly testing policies and practices that ensure that all HIV tests are voluntary and that they abide by international guidelines for testing. Most importantly, testing must always lead to access to treatment, care, and support services wherever and whenever they are needed. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Amara. Our final presenter in this session is Nduku Kilonzo. Nduku is the director of the Liverpool Voluntary Counseling, Testing, Care and Treatment, a Kenyan national non-governmental organization comprising more than 250 staff who provide VCT services to approximately 250,000 individuals each year, as well as HIV treatment to more than 16,000 Kenyans. The organization also conducts operations and formative research on HIV service delivery. Nduku's own research has looked at the links between sexual violence and HIV, and among other things has provided evidence for the development of integrated post-rape care services currently offered in 15 public health facilities in Kenya. Nduku has served as a technical advisor to the WHO, including their committees on HIV counseling and testing and violence against women. She's also a member of the coordinating group of the Sexual Violence Research Initiative. Nduku.
Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm going to be talking specifically. Okay, sorry, I'm trying to get this to work. I'm going to be looking at the gender dimensions of HIV and having a discussion around what the issues are, what the new approaches are and what they mean to scaling up counseling and testing, what they mean for gender. And finally, I look at the opportunities we have for responding and make a couple of recommendations on the way forward. To start off, I would like to start by looking at the numbers with regard to gender and HIV in Kenya. This is just to kind of give a backdrop and an overview of some of the discussions that I'm going to be having, and I will base my discussion on the challenges, the issues, and the experiences of our organization. HIV prevalence is twice amongst females that of males. Women who are 15 to 24 years are four times more likely to be HIV infected, and increasing HIV prevalence in rural areas is what is seen in Kenya. Now, not 70% of Kenya's population lives in the rural areas, but more important, 84% of this population is of women live in rural areas. While male HIV prevalence has been related to education, it is significantly, women's lower education is significantly associated with HIV prevalence. And the rates of new infection are higher among men. There is high discordance, and the polygamous unions are more likely to be HIV infected. This data is from the Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey, which was released last week in Kenya. Beyond the numbers, what do we see? First, I would like to say that when we talk about sexual practice and sexual behavior in the context of counseling and testing, we need to realize that discursive practices around sexual behavior, that is when, who, how, and where I should have sex, are really determined mainly by the individual, but are framed within cultural norms. And women are less likely to have, women were, let me not say, were less likely to have access to VCT in Kenya around 2005, and males have more decision-making power. Now, it's very clear, as many parts of Africa and perhaps the world today, that we are seeing an additional epidemic around gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, and that has implications because there is very blurred boundaries between sex, between coerced, consensual, and forced sex. And the perceptions of risk amongst women, particularly married women, is that the law. And finally, with regard to counseling and testing, why many people said that they would not test or they had not undertaken an HIV test is because my partner's results are mine. So if my partner has tested, I really don't need to test. What's the background for VCT in Kenya? I think we are coming from a space where, not only in Kenya, but the VCT as a model of service delivery, where we protected stigmatized persons around the 80s, 90s, hence confidentiality, human rights, and I say versus public health approach with caution for the simple reason that it seems that there has been a discussion or a discourse that has pitted human rights imperative against a public health imperative, which I think, in my opinion, it should be and rather than or. And again, counseling was meant to support coping, particularly in a context where we did not have treatment. Responsibility for HIV prevention rested on individuals where, you know, we had a range of models, ABC and so on. And VCT models were mainly Western located, and they were premised on individualized healthcare seeking behavior, individualized sexual decision making capacity, and, you know, really levels of monogamy. If you go to a VCT service, it was really counseling and testing for you as an individual, and your plan, your eventual plan, was about you changing your sexual behavior. Now, Kenya's history around counseling and testing, Liverpool VCT Care and Treatment started the first three VCT sites in 1998, and currently Kenya has well over 1,000 sites, and as an organization, we've tested about 940,000 people. In 2006, Kenya developed approaches or new models of counseling and testing, some to be able to deliver services and to scale up coverage of knowledge of HIV status, including mobile, provider-initiated, community-based HIV counseling and testing, which has commonly been referred to as door-to-door. And Kenya is committed to universal access to counseling and testing with a goal of 80% coverage of knowledge of HIV status by 2010. So, what have these approaches meant for uptake of counseling and testing services? One, why do we need people to know their HIV status? It's necessary for care and treatment. It is a right for all. I really believe that when we talk about HIV prevention, treatment, and care, everyone has a right to treatment, everyone has a right to care, everyone also has a right to know their HIV status. The questions around the data and evidence for prevention are currently quite conflicting. Now, this is data from the DHS in Kenya in 2003 and the AIDS Indicator Survey in 2007, and you can see clearly that there was a huge increase or uptake of counseling and testing among females over the last and has been linked to the new testing approaches, mobile VCT, community-based counseling and testing, and provider-initiated counseling and testing that actually deliver the service to the client. I just kind of drew on our data as an organization. We looked at static VCT sites, which includes the provider-initiated testing and counseling. And again, you can see clearly that the female uptake has increased between, this is data from June 2007 to 2008, and we find that there is high numbers of women uptaking counseling and testing. So what are the gender issues that emerge, and how do we begin to deal with them? One, I think we need to rethink the models of HIV counseling and testing. They've been based on very individualized counseling, individualized risk reduction, risk assessment, individualized forward planning, individualized testing and delivery of results. Yet we know sexual practice is socially defined. Multiple partnerships is something that has been associated with increased risk of HIV and high prevalences. However, we also need to be cognizant that multiple partnerships are largely sanctioned, at least in the Kenyan community, and this is amongst men, and I would almost say implicitly amongst women, because it is the same communities that sanction multiple partnerships amongst men that expect men to actually have those partners from somewhere, and that is the women. And we have limited sexual decision-making power among women, yet in the counseling and testing models, you're providing counseling and testing and planning for the way forward with an individual and expecting them to go into back to wherever it is that they come from and be able to make decisions about changing sexual behavior. The second issue I want to speak to around models is about reconceptualizing risk. We have for a long time used the moral framework that looks at you should have only one partner, A, B strategies. It is really monogamy-based, yet polygamy is an accepted way of life. I come from an extended family where most of my relatives are polygamous, and that is an accepted way of life. So while there's a need to change the social and gender norms, which take a long while, how are we dealing with HIV and being able to provide counseling and testing in this context? What is the understandings of risk by gender? Women said that they were at low risk, married women, yet from the Kenya AIDS Indicator Survey data, what is very clear is that highest risk is among married couples, and I shall talk about disclosure and discordance briefly in a short while. And then also risk, the risk that we talk about in the VCT context assumes that sex is consensual. It does not take into context gender-based violence. It does not take into context coercive sex, particularly in intimate partner relationships. Further, assumptions of heterogeneity amongst women. It almost is like all the protocols for counseling and testing are very standardized across the world. I'm pretty sure it would be, you know, information, assessment, testing, post-test counseling. It actually assumes that one size fits all counseling and testing. There isn't messaging that is directed or particularly gender desegregated, nor do we have targeted prevention or messaging for women by age, yet we know that, for instance, women who are 15 to 24, particularly in Kenya, are more likely to be at risk of HIV infection. We do not have targeted messaging by HIV risk. Secondly, part of counseling and testing really focuses on being able to provide treatment and care. And it appears to be gender blind in the sense that uptake of counseling and testing, uptake of care and treatment services thereafter, and ability to be able to be retained in the healthcare system based on a report by the Social Determinants of Health are gender-based. And finally, current definitions of couples. Current definitions of couples as monogamous are problematic because polygamy, one, is acceptable. Two, with the question of serial monogamy, how do I know the knowledge of couples' HIV status at the point at which they engage? Also, women's agency in the context of counseling and testing does not seem to be taken into account. And finally, in the definition of couples, youth seem to be missing or seem to be lacking because we don't talk about youth couples, how is that defined? And yet, that's a high-risk group. Consent. What is consent? For what? For information, for testing, for results? Who asks for consent? From whom? Consent from health provider client relationships is problematic or has been shown to be contextual, depending on who asks, depending on the language that is used, depending on the potential consequences of giving or not giving consent. And then perceptions of consent by providers and general populations, and human rights activists seem to differ. If I draw on lessons on anonymity and confidentiality in Kenya for VCT, we actually found that people were less worried about having their names written on VCT cards than health providers and human rights advocates thought for a very long time. And again, we seem to have double standards. If it's VCT for PMTCT in reproductive health settings, do you require the same consent? And for what are you asking consent? Vis-a-vis VCT delivered in a supply-driven section or in a demand-driven section such as VCT. Finally, disclosure of sexual practice is socially constructed, and disclosure, intended disclosure, is higher than actual disclosure, and supported disclosure has been an issue that is very, very highly contested. However, we do know why it has been highly contested around experiences of violence, but we also know that women have been largely supported. And there are some additional concerns around disclosure that we do not talk about generally. One is children and families and extended families. Why do we need disclosure? If you look at that graph, it actually tells us, and this is from CAIS data, that 45% of people in married relationships in Kenya are in discordant relationships. So to finalize, how do we respond to these issues? What are the opportunities that exist, and how can we utilize them? I think there's one thing to say is that the question can no longer be a question of whether we scale up counseling and testing, but it can only be a question of how we make it responsive. This is the total number of Kenyans who need cotrimoxazole currently, but do not even know their HIV status. These are the people who need CTX and are currently on prophylaxis. That is 12%. And this here is the people who need prophylaxis, know their status, but are not on prophylaxis. This 84% must be reached. Let's also remember that the highest infection prevalence is amongst women. In conclusion, we need gender-responsive counseling and testing. We need to re-engage counseling to ensure that opportunities for counseling facilitate sexual discussion amongst couples and families, and that we are no longer talking about individuals. We need to engage supported disclosure and partner notification. We cannot continue to run away from that. And we need options because it provides an option to support negotiation and knowledge of partner status. We need to be able to redefine risk and knowledge of partner status, because currently our understanding of risk is based on ABC frameworks on one partner, yet the question of risk actually seems to be way outside that given the current data. And we need to be able to develop gender audits for counseling and testing programs, evaluate counseling and testing programs, develop quality assurance programs within counseling and testing that look at the implications of counseling and testing, whether it is provider-initiated, door-to-door, or it is VCT, from the perspective of the implications for men and women. Messaging needs to be gender-targeted, and we need to refocus on male uptake of counseling and testing. Thank you very much.
Thank you to all presenters for their wonderful speeches. We will now start our Q&A section with some reflections by Gracia Violeta Ross Quiroga. Violeta is an anthropologist by training, and she's a human rights activist for people living with HIV and AIDS. She currently is the Latin American Caribbean NGO representative on the UNAIDS board, and from that capacity, she participates in the second independent evaluation of UNAIDS, and she's a member of the search committee for the executive director of UNAIDS. She has helped establish Red Ball, the Bolivian Network of People Living with HIV, which she led as executive director from 2005 to 2007, and is an active member of the international community of women living with HIV/AIDS. Violeta has been honored on many occasions for her tireless work and commitment. Thank you, Violeta.
Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you to all the speakers for your presentations. I really learned a lot myself in the session, although I read the presentations in advance. Just to tell you one more thing about me, and which I believe is the most important. I was a rape victim in 1998, and in 2000 I tested HIV positive without my consent. And this was not the government or any migration office who took me there. It was my love sister, my older sister. Because of the situation of rape and because I was not feeling so well, she really wanted me to make this test. And after coming back home from a trip, she realized that I was not feeling well. So we assumed I had yellow fever. And we went to the lab of my uncle, and we said, okay, make the yellow fever test than anything else. And she said, without my consent, also do the HIV test, because she's been a victim of rape. And by that night, she already knew that I was HIV positive, and I didn't know. Next day, she said, I will go with you to collect those tests. And I said, why? When they gave me those tests, I cannot explain what I felt, because really I was not expecting that situation. I didn't have any idea of how I've been at risk of HIV, because the messaging I received was gay men, drug users and sex workers, those are at risk, not you, a regular woman in the world. And because of that, I didn't believe those tests were real. I thought my sister and somebody else were playing a joke for me. And, you know, I went in complete denial. And my sister just walked after me from the center because she knew I was about to kill myself that very moment. I went to a bridge, which is very famous in La Paz for suicide, and I think I was going to do it. She actually forced me and took me into the taxi and took me home. Because of that, I was angry at her for a year, you know, because she didn't ask my permission. I was not ready to receive those news at that moment. I felt she took away my freedom to enjoy life. And that maybe this is part of the testing when it doesn't happen with consent. And imagine what happens when you are vulnerable for any situation. From what the speaker said, I can say on my reflections that any approach for testing that will test people whose human rights are undermined, or people who are in situations of vulnerability, a migrant, a man who has sex with men, a pregnant woman, a rape survivor, a young person, anyone who is in a situation of vulnerability, that testing will be taken as a intromission in your intimacy and will not help. And after, when I work in the Bolivian network of people with HIV, we saw that people who were taken to test without their consent, the impact on their lives is like a boomerang. They don't acknowledge they are living with HIV. They don't adhere to the medicines. They don't accept the fact that they are HIV positive. And some people even go and engage in more risk behavior. So maybe my questions to you is, whose rights do we need to protect in testing for HIV? Those of the individual, those of the government, those of a country who don't want to receive the migrants, or those of the baby, those of the husband, and whose ability to decide are we honoring in these approaches of testing? That of the health minister, that of any agency, or that of individuals. I don't think any approach that does not consider a gender approach, a human rights approach, and a continuation service from testing to care and support will not be successful. And I just wanted to say this to you now and follow your discussions. Thank you.
Okay, we have a little over 15 minutes for questions and answers. I understand that there are some volunteers with cards on which you can write your questions. Is that right? If not, we will just use the microphones. Well, apparently there are no cards. So if whoever wants to ask a question, could line behind the mics, please. And I wonder if we could turn on the lights. Well, not these lights, but the room. ¿Pueden prender las luces del auditorio? Estas, por favor, bájenlas porque está demasiado intensa. Anyway, yes, please. I'll take a few questions and then ask the speakers to respond.
Hi, I'm Terry Ford from AIDS Healthcare Foundation. I want to thank you for all your presentations, especially from Kenya. I thought that was a fantastic presentation. There's no possibility for universal access to treatment without universal access to testing, and we put the cart before the horse. We have 1 minute HIV tests now that require no refrigeration. We have pre-test counseling, and mobile tests has never been more mobile. What we're missing is the will. We're calling for 1 million tests on World AIDS Day around the world. There's no way we're going to stop this virus without 1 billion tests a year. We need to do 1 million HIV tests this World AIDS Day week. We can sign up at booth 229, because the ultimate human right is the right to life. As you said from Kenya, public health and human rights are not adversaries. We need to unite them. This is a public health issue, and we need to do 1 million tests around the world. World AIDS Day, and we call on everybody to sign up for that. I actually don't have a question. I'm just saying we really need to commit to the will to create the testing that will create the treatment. And as we know, now treatment is prevention. Treatment suppresses the virus enough that it is one of the most important parts of prevention today. Thank you.
Thank you very much. But if you could make very pointed questions, please.
Hello, my name is Diedrich Lohmann, and I work for Human Rights Watch. I have a question for Ralph. Ralph, you talked about, on the one hand, VCT, and on the other hand, provider-initiated testing in healthcare settings. But what we're seeing across Southern Africa is a proliferation of other models. For example, we've done research on the Know Your Status campaign in Lesotho, where several thousand lay counselors were trained and then sent into villages to do testing in people's homes and in the communities. And I wonder if you've also looked at the human rights implications of those kinds of approaches. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Gabrielle. I'm from Canada, and I'm with an NGO, the World Youth Alliance.
Can you speak up a little, please?
Sorry. I'm with the World Youth Alliance. And I was just wondering, this is kind of a general question, what is being done to promote voluntary couples testing to empower both a man and a woman in the relationship, because often women are stigmatized or abused because of their diagnosis? And, excuse me, what is being done to promote couples testing? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Hilary Holmans, and I just really wanted to make a comment rather than a question, and that is that UNHCR has also been looking at these issues in relation to humanitarian populations of concern and find that in many countries their populations of concern are being tested in refugee camps, are being tested, children, unaccompanied minors are being tested before being placed in orphanages. And we have numbers of examples. And for those reasons, I'd like to commend the work that Ralph was talking about, and just to let people know that UNHCR has also developed some draft guidance in response and, in addition, complementary to the PITC guidance.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Alex Doyen. I work with a company called Vistagard Franzen, based in the Regional Africa office in Nairobi. I just had an open question to the panel. I think that there is a consensus that testing and counseling needs to be scaled up rapidly, and that you need specific testing and counseling, you know, such as gender-specific for different contexts. Now, there's been some studies of incentivized testing and counseling, not so much to coerce people into testing and counseling, but to compensate them for the test, for the cost of attending the testing facilities. So I would just like to ask the panel, what is the opinion on that issue? Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, my name is Ima Alfaro, and I work for a private sector partnerships project in Guatemala. I would like to ask the panel, and I would like to ask the audience as well, if any of you have had experience that you can share in terms of voluntary counseling and testing models adequate for the private sector providers. Our project is focusing on physicians and clinical laboratories who offer private services, and I would like to know if you have any experience to that effect so that you can share. And I would also like to mention that I have brought with me some CDs that I can share on voluntary counseling testing events and toolkit for implementers, which I can share if someone is interested at the end of the session. Thank you.
Thank you. While more people line up, I would like to give the panelists a chance to respond. Ralph, you got a specific question, and you all got three open questions, and please volunteer to answer them.
Yes. Maybe I'll start with the comment that there's no possibility for universal access without universal access for testing. That's of course is true, and is also true that we're missing the will to scale up HIV testing and counseling adequately. However, I disagree with the fact that we need to or should scale up access to HIV testing without that being linked to increasing access to prevention, access to treatment, and increased stigma, discrimination, and human rights programs. I don't think we have evidence at all that simply increasing the number of tests will automatically lead to increased access to HIV treatment and increased prevention and decreased stigma. There is some kind of link, of course, but there is not a direct link, and that means that there needs to be a will to do all of the above rather than singling out one and focusing only on one. Secondly, Diederik, yes, we have looked also at issues related to home-based testing, and of course there are specific concerns related to that, and they are addressed in part in the paper I talk about, but because of lack of time, I was not able to talk about that in much detail. As with all these new types of testing, there are good and aspects about that, promising aspects. It's promising that this will lead to increased access to HIV testing, but there are also some concerns. And as with all the other aspects of HIV testing, those concerns need to be addressed. Maybe I'll leave some of the other panelists to address some of the other questions.
Nduku, Amara.
Okay.
Ailu.
Okay. I hope you can hear me. I think I'll speak to two of the questions. The first is providing voluntary couples HIV testing and counseling. There are approaches that have begun to look at couples. In Kenya, we are using faith-based organizations as an avenue for targeting couples because we do know that a lot of couples engage with churches or with other faith-based programs. The other option that we are looking at is the question, and I think that refers to what Raf has just talked about, home-based counseling and testing. If you looked at the data and the graph that I showed, it was the only program that seemed to have a certain and almost balanced number of men and women, and it's because we are targeting couples and families. I think the questions for me are engaging the human rights issues so that there is consent, there is a coercion. There are lots of guidance around coercion for women and violence work that has been done by the WHO that we have adopted as methods of being able to look at the ways in which or see how, whether or not women will be affected. The second issue is around the models for private sector. Yes, there are models for private sector. There's a private-public partnership currently running in Kenya between a couple of organizations in the private sector. And Liverpool is one of the counseling and testing providers. And what we have is we are able to provide counseling and testing mobile to workplaces, and we're able to link people who are into care and treatment anonymously to care and treatment programs for those who want anonymity within workplaces, because that is still an issue around stigma in workplaces.
I would like to give a chance to a few more questions. If you could respond quickly.
No, it's not. Okay, thank you. No. I'd like to respond to two questions. First, on their on our opinion regarding giving incentives for people who go for testing. I think it's a very interesting question. And looking at the context in my country, for instance, where there's very poor health-seeking behavior among Filipinos, and there's an attitude where where they fear knowing their HIV status, plus, of course, the cost of testing and treatment as deterrents to why they would voluntarily go for testing. I think it would be interesting to provide incentives. However, foremost is that we should never, ever forget that whatever tests we conduct, it should always look at access to treatment and services. And in certain contexts, like my country, where access to treatment and services for people living with HIV are limited, we are not in the position to actually be providing incentives so people will come for tests. The other question I'd like to respond to is regarding working with the private testing centers, private sectors. My organization, in collaboration with the Department of Health in my country, actually had a series of trainings for medical testing centers that conduct tests for migrant workers who leave the country. We trained their staff to conduct pre-test and post-test counseling. We've reached more than 80 testing centers. Unfortunately, the challenges are more daunting. One, the volume of migrants that are tested daily is just too much for counseling to be given on an individual or even group basis. And I'd like to respond to the woman who has a campaign on having 1 million tests a year. I'd like to inform you that just last year, the Philippines registered 1 million migrant workers leaving the country, which means that we tested 1 million migrants. Unfortunately, these are all mandatory tests. So please do not ever forget the kind of tests that are being conducted and the implications that they have on the people who are being tested. Thank you.
Thank you. Ralph, do you want to answer one of the questions now? If you could just take 1 minute, because there are three people.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something about the other testing statements that are being developed, because many of you are not aware of this. As I said, there is a testing statement, a policy statement that has been developed by WHO, UNODC, and UNAIDS on testing specifically for prisoners, and another one is being developed on testing specifically for people who use drugs. And there were two reasons behind the development of these specific additional policy statements. The first one was that there was a concern that the PITC guidance would be misinterpreted by people providing HIV testing in prisons or by legislators to make testing of prisoners routine and to make testing of people who use drugs routine. The second concern, however, was that these populations would continue to be, as they are specifically for prisoners, left out of efforts to scale up access to testing and treatment. So look out for those specific statements, one of which, as I said, will be available very shortly.
Thank you. Fatima Hassan from Treatment Action Campaign and AIDS Law Project South Africa. There are two groups that we are trying to figure out mechanisms to scale up testing for in South Africa and I think in the rest of Africa as well. And that's newborn babies, because we have an increasing infant mortality problem where if we don't diagnose early enough, we can't put them on treatment early enough. And that's a group that probably because of time has not been addressed here. But what are the issues in other countries and what is the position of human rights activists to the routine PCR testing of all newborn babies, particularly where the status of the mother is unknown? And the second group that we are having a particular problem with is actually men. We are able to identify many women through a number of our family planning, contraception, antenatal, a number of clinics, TB, where women seek treatment earlier and seek testing earlier, but men are coming into the system too late. And I worry, and as a feminist and a gender activist, I do worry that we're not targeting men early enough and that the only time we do target men is in couple testing and couple counseling. So those are my two questions. Thanks.
Unfortunately, we will be able to take only one more question. Sorry, what is that? Oh, there is someone lining just up there. Okay.
I just would like to ask if there is any study of cost effectiveness of provider-initiated counseling and testing, because we know that percentage of people testing positive in VCT services is high. Usually it's higher than the prevalence in the country. So they are very cost-effective, this kind of services. And by the other way, with provider-initiated, we will make lots of tests, and many tests will be negative, and also the quality of the counseling will be very low. We usually see people testing positive in VCT service that has already been tested in a routine fashion by any doctor in any other services, so he or she was tested in an unusual and very costly manner. That's what I wanted to ask.
Thank you.
It's Tachisache. I'm the executive director of an NGO in Uganda called the Ugandan Network on Law Ethics and HIV/AIDS. I just wanted very briefly to share with participants another model we have been using, we have adopted in my organization in Uganda, is to provide VCT services during our training. We are an HIV/AIDS stroke human rights organization, and we have been surprised when we introduced VCT services wherever we provide training for human rights and HIV/AIDS. The uptake has been very high. People freely consent to testing. They receive their results. And the point I wanted to share here is that those who are pushing for testing without consent, they need to re-examine why people are not taking up VCT services. Otherwise, when we've inquired from the people we've trained why they haven't tested, quite often people raise issues like distance, fear, and, I never thought about it, or discrimination. But when you give them this opportunity, others also mentioned the barrier of cost, like a charge that is placed before they can take the test. Now, when you remove all these barriers, we've been very surprised that the uptake for VCT is very high, 80%. All the people want to take up their results, and the men are particularly also coming up, they test. So we need to challenge some of the data out there which says that people don't want to take, are not willing to come up to take voluntary counseling and testing, particularly outside healthcare services. I think there are many more reasons which we haven't explored, and I think we may not be, we are applying a diagnosis to a problem we haven't properly identified. Thank you
very much. Just in 1 minute, if someone wants to answer one of the last questions we got. Violeta?
Yeah. About the newborns, I don't know if we have a position on this, because in the networks of women living with HIV, I have seen two positions. Some are demanding voluntary counseling and testing, of course, but then I met another group of women in South America, in a particular country, who are mothers and their babies are dead by the time. And they are advocating for mandatory testing for all pregnant women, because they are saying, if I were tested when I was pregnant, my baby maybe was not going to be dead by now. So and in the same discussion, the feminist advocates who were not HIV positive were saying, you cannot do that with the pregnant women. And they were saying, if you lost your baby, you would say, yes, do that. So I didn't find a unified position among these two groups of women, so loved to my heart. And myself, I don't know what to say as a woman who wants to get pregnant today. But I think we have to protect the health of the babies and the mothers at the same time.
We will give Gerd the last word.
Yeah, just to say that studies show that when HIV testing and counseling is routinely offered to pregnant women, and it is recommended to them, the vast majority, and we're talking here 95 to 98% of women, will understand that the HIV test is beneficial to them and to the baby. And the very few women who do not accept the testing, in some studies they talk very eloquently why they feel they simply cannot do it because of fear of violence or other issues. So I think there is a clear answer. We shall not anymore compare VCT as it was done 10 years ago of pregnant women. We shall talk about routinely offering women, pregnant women, the test and explaining to them why the test is beneficial to them and to the child, and then let women make the decision for them and their babies.
Just for your information, very quickly, there are at least three sessions tomorrow and Thursday on a similar topic. One is the satellite session you got an announcement of. There is also a session called Optimizing HIV Testing Interventions tomorrow from 11 to 12:30 in room 5. And another one, HIV Testing New Models Shattering the Barriers to Universal Access to Treatment on Thursday from 6:30 to 8:30 in room 9. Thank you. Gracias.